Thank you very much. So the topic of today's reading week shiur is separation between religion and state. It's an interesting question: to what degree does halacha or Jewish tradition recognize some type of a separation between the state authority and the religious authority? And to what degree is it all sort of merged into one? My son Yamin, who is 9 years old, told me about a week ago that he's discovered that a good way to get people to think that he's smart is by looking at random words in the dictionary and then just using them in sentences. I asked him for an example of what word he's utilized that has caused people to think that he's smart. So he said anti-disestablishmentarianism. So that's a very well-known word because it's, I believe, the longest word in the English language. It has 28 letters and 12 syllables. But most people don't know what it means. I figure one of the perks of this year is that since it relates to what I'm talking about, I could tell you what it means. In the British Commonwealth, as opposed to the United States, there isn't actually a separation between religion and state in the same fashion. In the United States, it's understood on some level that religion and state are separated. The Constitution provides that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And according to Thomas Jefferson, in a letter that he wrote to the Danbury Baptist Association in 1802, the effect of this clause in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, in the First Amendment, of the Bill of Rights, so Thomas Jefferson said, thus building a wall of separation between church and state, that this effectively created this wall of separation. It's a big debate, even among later scholars and politicians, to what degree the Constitution really created in the United States an absolute wall and a complete separation between religion and state. But certainly in the British Commonwealth, in the British Empire, there is an official church of the state. The Anglican Church is the official church of the state of England. So there were people who wanted to disestablish the Anglican Church as the official church of England, so there shouldn't be an official state church. And they were called disestablishmentarianists. And their movement was, this is the movement of disestablishmentarianism. But then there was another group that fought hard against the first group and felt that it was important not to disestablish the Church of the State of England. So they were the anti-disestablishmentarianists. So the movement of the anti-disestablishmentarianists to make sure that the Church of England would remain the official church of the state is called anti-disestablishmentarianism. So that's the background of the word, and it relates very much to this discussion. To what degree do we feel strongly that there should be a connection between religion and state? So the mention, the first source that's in the Mare Mekomos here, the first mention kind of the notion of establishing a sovereign state and how that sovereign state somehow connects to the religious tradition is found in Devarim in connection with the appointment of a melech. That's Devarim Perek Yud Zayin in Parsha Shoftim, where we're told Som Tasim Alecha Melech, that you should appoint a melech, you should appoint a king, Asher Yuchar Hashem Elokech Habo. So already there's an intrinsic connection, because the king has to be appointed by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that we don't just go and pick our own kings, but the idea is that somehow this comes from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, it's all tied into our religious tradition. And then we're told that this king, in order to safeguard his perspective, that he should have a proper Torah perspective, he shouldn't have too many horses, he shouldn't have too many wives, and we're told in Pasuk Yudches, Vayachis Shivto al Kisei Ma'amlachto v'chosav lo es Mishnei HaTorah. He's also supposed to write, he's supposed to have a Sefer Torah with him at all times. The Haisa Imo, we're told in Pasuk Yates, Rekovavo Koyame Chayav, he has to constantly study the Torah and learn the Torah. Leman Yomad Yeras Hashem Elokav, in order that he should have proper Yeras Hashem. So we see that a king is supposed to be, on some level, a servant of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, on some very fundamental level. This is part of the character of the king. So a king is, on the one hand, an official monarch of the nation, with whatever powers a king would normally possess, but at the same time, a king is subservient to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and certainly subservient to the Torah. In fact, we're told, we're given a Tam HaMikra, explicitly in the text, in this particular case, in Pasachov, Levilti Rum Levavo Me'echav, that he should not promote himself as somehow being above the level of everybody else in terms of his commitment to Torah. The Levilti saw mina mitzvah yamina smol, that he shouldn't stray from the mitzvah of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, either to the right or to the left. L'man yarich yamim ha-mamlachto hu uvana bekerav Yisrael, so that this malchus shall be a lasting and enduring kingdom in the midst of Klal Yisrael. Now, Rashi, in his comments this set of psukim, Rashi says it's Mishnei HaTorah. Rashi learns Mishnei is a lashon of double. Shnei Sefrei Torah. Achashi Munachas Beis Gnozov, one which is always kept in storage with him. Achashi Knesses V'yotzei Zimo, and the other that the king, wherever he goes, wherever he travels, it has to be a traveling safer. It has to be something which is a living and breathing, a guide to how he should conduct his existence in everything that he does. And then Rashi points out that the very last pasuk that says "Hu uvanav" indicates that the malchus, once a king is chosen by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, then the malchus does pass on to further generations. But uvanav means that it is a son like him who is bound by all of these other precautions. Magichim b'no hagun l'malchus, that the son has to be dafka hagun l'malchus who kodem l'chol adam. So what does hagun mean? We have this notion elsewhere as well, also with the Kohen Gadol. We're told that it will be passed on to his sons as well. So what is, it has to be it has to be a takta mibanav, kind of association where the child is a mimali makom takas aviv, where the child has the qualities that the father is supposed to have. So what is the chief quality that a king, somebody in a position of high authority, is supposed to have in terms of the malchus Yisrael? So if you look at the Gemara in Ksubas and Daf Kuf Gimels, the Gemara talks about when Rebbe passed away. So when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi passed away, he was the Nasi. The Nasi position, certainly in the time of Rebbe, was a position that was considered to be the Hemsheikh of the Malchus. They were from the family of Malchus, the Malchus Yehuda, that was passed on to his family, and therefore there was a passage of the monarchy at the time that Rebbe passed away. And Rebbe decreed that before he died, the Gemara says that he decreed that Gamliel, his son, should be the Nasi, even though Shimon, his son, is a Chacham. So it sounds like he was saying Shimon is the bigger Talmid Chacham. Shimon really is somebody who was greater in terms of his personal intellect and perhaps academic accomplishment, but nonetheless, Gamliel should become the Nasi, should become Rabban Gamliel the Nasi. So Amalevi says the Gemara Tzricha Lameima, why did he have to say that? Gamliel was the Bechor, he was older anyway. So I'm a Rabbi Shimon Balevi, no, Tzricha Lachum et Halaseich, that this is absolutely necessary, and he threw in a little dig. My Kashalei, what was bothering Levi? Levi was handicapped, he had made an allusion to his being handicapped, so he said, Hakra Kamar. So Levi said that what bothered Levi is that it's a pasuk that Gamliel was the Bechor. So obviously the Malchus goes to the Bechor. Mamlach anas in the Yoram Kiwa Bechor. The Malchus goes, the Rambam writes, that the laws of Yerusha apply to the passage of Malchus, that they follow normal laws of Yerusha. The Bechor comes first, gets Pishnaim. So when it comes to the passage of the kingdom, it goes to the Bechor. So says the Gemara, no, it goes to the Bechor when the Bechor is a Mimali Makam Avosav Abba, when he's a Mimali Makam Avosav. I'm a Gamliel, I ain't a Mimali Makam Avosav. You would have thought that Rabban Gamliel was not a Mimali Makam Abba. Why is that? Rebbe, my time of it, Hachi. So Rebbe, if in fact Rabban Gamliel was not a Mimali Makam, why did he make him into the Nasi? So he was being Mechadesh. What is the chief characteristic of being Mimali Makam? You might have thought that Rabban Gamliel was not really the Mamali Makom because he wasn't as big a Chacham as Shimon. He's Dana Mamali Makom Avosa B'Chachma, but nonetheless, B'Yiras Chet, Mamali Makom Avosa Paba, that since B'Yiras Chet, he was a Mamali Makom, so this was the chief characteristic. And this is also echoed by Tosos at the end of Menachos in the context of taking over as Kohen Gadol as well, that the chief characteristic is to be Mamali Makom, B'Yiras HaShemayim. So where does it come from that the chief characteristic for a king is that he's supposed to have Yiras HaShemayim? So I thought maybe it actually comes from the Psukim themselves, because the Psukim say, what is the main characteristic of a melech? In terms of a melech's perspective and a melech's qualifications, what is it that we want out of a melech? We want the melech to understand that he's subservient to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Where does that come from? You look in Pasuk Yutes, from the Parshas HaMelech, it says very clearly, V'haisa imo v'karavo ko yimei chayov, the Sefer Torah is supposed to be with the melech at all times. Why? Leman, what's the first and chief characteristic? Leman yomad, liyaras Hashem elokav, so that the king will understand that his main preoccupation has to be yiras Hashem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the king of, is the melech HaKavod. A king melech basav adab might come to the mistaken impression that he's the melech hakavod, that he somehow is the owner of all of the kavod, that all the kavod is supposed to come to him. So the first thing a king needs to understand is that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is the owner, is the melech hakavod, and that he has to give the kavod to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. He is not the master of the kavod belongs to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, this is the first principle in terms of our perspective of connection or separation between religion and state. It's quite clear that the state leader, namely the melech in our tradition, is somebody who has to be subservient to his religious principles. His first priority is Yiras Hashem. His first and main criterion and qualification is that he has to possess a Yiras Hashem, which is informed by his constantly carrying around the Torah. So of course the question is posed, why then was Shmuel HaNavi so upset when the nation asked for a king? And this will give us further insight into what separation may or may not exist. So Shmuel was a Navi, he was a shofet, he was governing everybody very smoothly, very nicely, and teaching them the ways of the Torah. Then he brought his sons into the picture. The sons were not quite as outstanding, it seems, as Shmuel himself was. And after some dissatisfaction with the sons, even though Shmuel was still in charge, the people turned to him and they said, Sima lanu melech l'shavtenu kechol ha-goyim. We want you to appoint us a melech. It says, Somta sima lech ha-melech, nu, so go and appoint us a melech. Vayero dover b'nei Shmuel. Shmuel was very upset about this, however. Kasher amu tina lanu melech l'shavtenu v'yispalel Shmuel Hashem. And Shmuel davened to Hashem, and Hashem said, don't worry, listen to them. It's not yourself they've rebelled against. They've rebelled against me. An interesting conversation that took place. But clearly, Shmuel was upset, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu also indicated that there was some rebellion going on over here. So the Ran has a famous discussion about this interaction between Shmuel and the people, and why it is that Shmuel was upset. And in the context of this discussion, the Ran explains what the different roles are of the melech on the one hand, of the king on the one hand, and of essentially the shoftim, those who are who are charged to carry out the halacha, those who are running the batei din, those who are running the sanhedrin, those who are in charge of legislating the Torah among the people. What's the difference between the Torah legislators on the one hand and the king on the other hand? Now the Drashas Haran were written, it's a big question as to who is the author of the Drashas Haran. Was it a Talmud of the Ramban, or was it the Ran who's on the side of the Rif? So the current scholarship seems to be that the author of the Drashas Haran was none other than the Ran himself. Of course, you can argue what difference does it make, you know, whether you know, Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare with somebody else. We'll call him Shakespeare. It was a great work. The Drushes of the Rhine were a great work either way. But it is nice to know, because we're more familiar with the Rhine on the Rip. It's somebody who we've come to, you know and love. So for just the reference purposes, the general assumption seems to be that the Drushes of the Rhine were in fact written by the Rhine. And there were all kinds of riots for this. You'll pick up, you know, the latest version. We'll look at the introductions to the Drushes of the Rhine. I have over here, I brought with me a Drushes of the Rhine. It was put out just a few years ago by Aryeh Feldman from the Machon Shalem in Yerushalayim. And he goes to great length in the Hakdama to demonstrate that the Drushes of the Rhine were written by the same Rhine who is the Rhine on the Rif. So the Rhine writes he thinks that there are two different inyanim that have to be carried out in the course of running an effective sovereign state, of running a government. So you look in, go to page 2 of the Maror Mekomos, and the third line says, "V'ein sofek ki b'chol echam etzdadim yisdam neshnei inyanim." That there are basically two different types of enforcement that need to be carried out by the melech on the one hand, and by the shoftim, by those who are legislating pure Torah law. And he says that one cannot really infringe upon the other, that it's important for dayanim, for the shoftim, to carry out pure Torah law. There is a certain mishpat emes that always has to be carried out. That's the job of the shofet. Sometimes you will have, especially if you're trying to administer law and order in society, it'll turn out you don't have the requisite hasra, you don't have the requisite shnei edim, but it'll be clear that somebody committed a crime, and in order to preserve law and order, various punishments and various measures will need to be taken. But you can't do it according to strict Torah law, and there's a value to preserving the pristine nature of strict Torah law, and therefore we're not going to have the shoftim trespass upon that. But it will be necessary in order to be able to address the needs of the time and of the government and of the country, it will be necessary to take some sort of a measure. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave each one of these roles to a separate position. So therefore there was a commandment to appoint shoftim in order to judge according to pure Torah law and to show the world what Torah law really is all about, because there's a very pristine and precise nature to how Torah law is supposed to be administered. And that is what we call the Mishpat Tzedek. Okay, that this is what they are supposed to do. You're supposed to do pure Torah law, and they're not allowed to do more than that. However, since this is not going to be enough in order to effectively run a government where you're not going to have all of the standards satisfied in every single case, but you're still going to have to preserve law and order, even if not every single detail of Torah procedure has been satisfied. So that's why you need as sort of a supplementary position, the position of the melech. So they both are separate and distinct, but they're working towards common goals. The understanding is that you have to preserve the integrity of the Torah. Therefore, the shoftim have to be able to operate within their own domain without going outside of that domain. And yes, we do have a principle of makin ve'onshin shalom min adin, but says the Ran, makin ve'onshin shalom min adin is essentially a governmental function which is taken over by Sanhedrin when you don't have a functional monarchy in the Jewish state, when you don't have that luxury, so then Sanhedrin has to take over that function. But in the ideal universe, you have the pristine Torah law which is administered by the shoftim, and then the melech's job is to go above and beyond, but with the recognition that even though he goes beyond, even though he's doing administering punishment not necessarily purely according to Torah law, administering certain precepts not strictly according to Torah law, it's in order to enable the essential Torah society to flourish, and therefore his job is to be able to kind of provide supplementary justice. But because of the fact that this is perilous, since a king might think, oh, he's above the law. That's why it's especially important, the Ran goes on to say, great land, for the Melech to constantly have the Sefer Torah with him, so he'll understand that ultimately his purpose is to safeguard a society that is run according to the Torah. So what then was the sin that was committed by the people in the time of Shmuel in asking for a Melech? So says the Ran, now we understand what their Avera was, because what did they ask for? They ask for a melech to nalanu melech l'shaftenu. Give us a melech l'shaftenu kechol ha-goyim, to judge us according to all the goyim. But judging, the strict justice that's supposed to occur in society, is not supposed to come from the melech. The melech just serves a supplementary role. The main judging and justice comes from the shoftim, and it's not the job of the melech to be the shofet. So therefore, as says the Ran, look in the next paragraph, that the sin that they committed, this is the last word of the second line, they wanted for their mishpat, their justice system, to be decided strictly according to some secular system of law that would be promulgated by the melech. And this is antithetical to Torah. The essential system of law has to be the Torah system of law, and the melech's job is simply a supplementary job. If they would have just said, give us a melech, then lo yara be'enav, says the Ran. Three lines from the bottom of the paragraph. Amasha hukshalo, bashir amu l'shaftenu. That is what bothered him. B'nei zeh amar Hashem l'shmuel, and that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Shmuel, lo'oskam asu ki osim ha'asu mimloch aleihem, that it's not against you, it's against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kehem bochrim b'tikun inyonim ativi, because they just want to follow the regular ways of the world to be a nation like any other nation, mishiyachob eminyan ha'loki, rather than to have this special spiritual exalted status of living according to the Torah. Then he goes on to say, you should say, ahevdil ben ha'shofet ve'ha'melech. This is the difference between the shofet and the melech. She'ha'shofet meshubah yotel le'mishpatei ha'torah me'ha'melech. The shofet has to be more subservient in terms of following the strict letter of the law. And because the melech goes beyond that, because the melech gets to use extrajudicial remedies in order to instill law and order, that's why the melech was required to always have the Sefer Torah with him in order to remind him of his essential and fundamental requirement to have allegiance to the Torah, and that with the main system of law governing the people should always be that of the Torah. Three lines in the bottom of Beshofet Lahutzach L'Kol Eilu. But somebody who's the Shofet, who's living his life in the Beis Medrash, living his life according to the pure Torah law, doesn't need all of these Asaras. But Sheyachol to Mugbal Kafim Mishpat Torah, because his powers are circumscribed by the Torah. Be'Amo V'Shavtu Asar Mishpat Tzedek, and therefore it wasn't necessary to constantly walk around with the Sefer Torah. Now, this idea is further found in later literature. It's found actually in, I guess, literature that pertains to later times, of the Rashba, where the Rashba has a tshuva which is cited in Siman Beis in Shulchan Aruch and Kol Shem Mishpat, which deals with the concept of Bezdin Makim Ve'onshin Shelo Min Adin, in which the Rashba picks up on this, as the Ran had alluded to, that when there is no Malchus that is kind of making sure that you have law and order, when the Torah precepts itself would not enable you to take action in a certain case, so then Bezdin has to step up to the plate in those cases. So the Rashba talks about that and explains that this is the duality of function that ends up being assumed by Bezdin in times where there is no Malchus. Take a look. Because the Rashba b'tshuva, the punishments can be meted out in order that the world just be able to exist. Because if you follow the pure Torah law when it came to these matters of preserving society, then then the whole world would become desolate. Shayinu tzrichem edim v'asra, we need edim and asra in every single case. K'mosha amuzal, as and then he quotes the Gemara, lochavi yushayim el shamidu zimineim al din Torah, that sometimes it's not enough to simply base yourself on that structure. That's the essential structure, but sometimes you need to take supplementary measures in order to preserve the structure. The kosher came a chutzlar, it's certainly outside of Eretz Yisrael, she'ein donin dine knossos, and mitzvah kalidas, portzin gidro shalolam, where we wouldn't have the ability to judge certain types of cases, penal cases and the like, and then people who would take advantage of the situation would go and they would pillage and plunder. V'nimsa olam shamem, and the world would become desolate. Karkonsus al kenosos makis kaveru biyad. And therefore, we have to take extrajudicial measures. So these people who are chosen to administer justice, if they see that it's appropriate to impose capital punishments and the like, in order for the Medina to be able, in order for the society to be able to remain standing, and then for sure that is appropriate, and it's not surprising that the continuation of this statement is v'kol shekein medika homin and demalka, and kol shekein when there is some sort of a malchus which is authorizing it, like the case of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, who was appointed by the melech to apprehend criminals. And therefore, this is consistent with the essential dichotomy, which is set forth by the Ran, between the role of the melech, the role of the state, and the role of the shoftim, of those who are administering the religious law of the state. Now, it's interesting, the Ramban, page 3 of the sources, the Ramban has a different teretz as to why the request for a king was considered to be objectionable by Shmuel. And he says the reason that it was considered to be objectionable in his mind was because Shmuel was doing everything. V'haya kol zeh, the third paragraph of Mipnei Shmuel Shofi V'Novi V'Lochem El Chomosem Api Hashem Moshio. So says sometimes you need a melech, but with Shmuel you didn't need a melech, he was doing it all. Therefore, it wasn't appropriate to ask for a melech altogether. So from the Ramban's approach, it sounds like it's not necessarily always the ideal that you need to have the separation of two different powers. You only need to have the two different powers if, for whatever reason, the person who is the shofet and the navi is not able to do it all. If you happen to have a shofet who is able to do it all, he's not intrinsically bothered by the notion of this individual also kind of serving in the role of the melech as well. While according to the Ran, the ideal really is that you keep it separate because it's necessary to have both kind of serve in as pristine a manner as possible. That if it's possible to have a Sanhedrin, really the main focus is on preserving the integrity of the religion, preserving the integrity of those who are charged to be the pure religious authorities, the Shoftim, if they're able to function in which in a way in which they are just administering Torah law in as pristine a fashion as possible. That is the preference, that you then have a separate melech who's kind of doing all of the other things. The Ramban seems to indicate that if you have one individual who could do it all, so then that would be perfectly fine. Now, the Ramban, however, goes further with sort of a different comment on how he understands the nature of there being a Torah principle of requiring a separation of a religion and state. And he says that when you do have a melech, when you do have somebody who's appointed for the purpose of a malchus, so we have a very clear Torah imperative of lo yaso shevet miyehuda, that it has to be from a certain shevet. It has to be from shevet Yehuda. It's not allowed to stray from that shevet. And therefore, if somebody is assuming what would be the malchus, this is separate from the function of the malchus. He said Shmuel was doing the function of the malchus, so what was the problem? Once you actually appoint somebody in that position of a melech, so then it's a very important, he's focusing on preserving the integrity of the malchus, that the malchus has to be dafka from Shevet Yehuda, and it's considered to be an avera to have anybody else sitting in that position. And he says, in fact, v'zeh ha'yonesh ha'chashmonoyim shemalchu b'vayesheni. This is the onesh, says the Ramban, at the end of Bereshis, Perek Memtes, Pasuk Yud, this was the onish of the Hashmonaim. This is why they ended up getting punished. They ended up falling before their enemies after the time of the Nes of the Hashmonaim, when they remained in their position, because the Hashmonaim were not at all from Sheva Yehuda. Where were they from? Who were the Hashmonaim? They were Kohanim. They were Kohanim. Now, Kohanim is sort of, you know, the paradigm of the ultimate religious and spiritual leaders of the nation, and they assumed the Malchus. So says the Ramban that they were punished because they weren't from, he says there were two reasons they were punished. Number one, they were punished because they were not from Sheva Yehuda, and even though they were Chassidei Elyon, the Torah would have been completely forgotten. Nonetheless, they were punished with a terrible punishment because they violated this requirement that the Malchus only be in a specific place with a specific Shevet. It has to be from Malchus Yehuda. And therefore, that is why they suffered a terrible calamity in all of the years that they served as malachim. Despite the fact that if you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Chanukos, the Rambam speaks very praisingly about how they saved, you know, Torah by virtue of taking over the Malchus. The Ramban says they were ultimately punished because of the fact that they were not from Sheva Yehuda. But then the Ramban goes further and he says the problem wasn't only that they weren't from Sheva Yehuda. That is one very important principle, that the Malchus has to remain pristine and it can't have any intrusion from anyone who's not from Malchus Yehuda. But the fact that they were Kohanim made it even worse. The fact that they were supposed to be the spiritual and religious leaders of the people, there was a separate prohibition upon Kohanim serving in a role of Malchus. And he says, Ve'esha gamkein shayolem chet b'malchusom ipnei shahayu Kohanim. Because the Kohanim are told very explicitly, Tishmeru eskehuna eskem nechol devar ha-mizbeach, their job was the Mizbeach. Their job was taking care of the spiritual welfare of the people, and therefore they strayed too far by virtue of the fact that they went beyond their Avodas Hashem and they assumed the mantle of the Malchus. And then the Ramban is Doresh Smuchin. I don't know if it's found otherwise. He's Doresh Smuchin. You could do that, right, in Sefer Dvarim, that we had the psukim that we quoted at the beginning of the beginning of our shiur today from Shoftim, where it says the vilti rum levavo meecha vilti suam min mitzvah yom in small lemayin yarich yamim amamachto hu vana bekeri Yisrael. The melech is supposed to remain in his position of machus bekeri Yisrael, and then immediately afterwards, at the beginning of the next parak, the very next pasuk says, "Lo yiyeh lekohanim alevim kol shevet chelik benachla im Yisrael." Kol shevet Levi chelik benachla im Yisrael. That since we have this juxtaposition, that in the one pasuk it talks about who the melech is going to be, and the next pasuk it says, "Lo yiyeh lekohanim alevim." So we learn from this juxtaposition that Kohanim are not supposed to serve in the position of a melech, that there's supposed to be a break. So the Ramban also appreciates this notion that once you have an actual position of melech, although he's prepared to embrace the idea that the functions can be served without such a position, once you have the position can't be assumed, number one, by anyone who's not from Sheva Yehuda. Number two, there's a special extra prohibition upon anyone who's charged with the spiritual welfare of the nation of assuming the mantle of melech, because the mantle of melech comes with it this notion of Malchus, of lording over the people, of governmental sovereignty, that's inconsistent with the mission of the Kohanim, which is supposed to be Rak Lavo Des Avodas Hashem. So there's a Gemara in Zevachim, which is also found in the Gemara in Zevachim, Daf Nun Gimel Amud Beis. It's also found in the Gemara with a slightly different formulation, the Gemara Megillah, Daf Chavav, which seems to underscore this distinction of the Ramban. Because the Gemara there points out that there was a kind of a gerrymandering of the district. of Yerushalayim, of which the Shevet was entitled to different portions of the land. This is related to this discussion of Yerushalayim l'niskalku l'shvatim. And the Gemara there says that that there was a certain portion of the Beis HaMikdash area that pertained to Sheva Yehuda, the Azaros, the Lishkos, the Harabayas pertained to Sheva Yehuda. However, the main area of Avoda in the Beis HaMikdash belonged to Shevet Binyamin. This is the translation, right, of the Unkelus on the Pasuk of Binyamin Zeb Yitrof Abokir Yochel Ad, and the Unkelus throws in Vachsante Yisro Yisbenei Makdasha, that in the portion of Binyamin, that's where the Beis HaMikdash is going to be built. So the way that the Mizbeach, the way that the area that belonged to Yehuda kind of went up to the area of the Mizbeach, and then the Mizbeach went to Binyamin. And that there was one place of the Mizbeach, the Keren Mizrachis Deromis, the east, the southeastern corner, which belonged to Yehuda and not to Binyamin. Ola Tunas Yesod, says the Gemara, Korban Ola requires that the blood be placed on the Yesod, the base on the Mizbeach, we carry Mizrach, that there be a base on the Mizbeach, where the blood is going to be thrown, there be a base on the bottom. The carry Mizrach is Dromis, Lo Haya La Yesod. But the east of the south or eastern corner did not have a Yesod. Why didn't it have a Yesod? Why didn't it have? And that's why the blood was not thrown on the southeastern corner of the Mizbeach. So why is it that the southeastern corner didn't have a Yesod? So I'm Rabbi Allah, it wasn't in the Chalik, Binyamin is called the Torah. Why is it? Because of the fact that it was not in the Chalik of Binyamin, and the Mizbeach had to be in the Chalik of Binyamin. There was this one Amma area at the corner of the Mizbeach that belonged to Yehuda. And therefore, you couldn't build a Yesod in that area because you couldn't have a Voda in that area. There was like a thin strip that went out from the Chalik of Yehuda, went into the Chalik of Binyamin. Rabbi Yamin at Sadik Mistair Alevichoyom Lenotla. Binyamin, who knew in the prophecy that was given at the time Yaakov was giving the brachos at the end of Sefer Devarim, so he knew that this was going to be in Yehuda's portion, and therefore, in the worst way, he wanted this portion as well. He wanted to take it. The Girsa in the Gemara Megillah is Lebola. He wanted to swallow it. Shenem Achofef Olav Kol Hayom. That he was always hovering over the Mizbeach. He wanted this portion. Lefikach zocha Binyamin etzadik v'nasir shpizcha on the Kodesh Baruch Hu, because it was so important to Binyamin to have every single inch, every single part of the territory of the Mizbeach. Therefore, Binyamin was made into the host for Kodesh Baruch Hu. Rashi explains in Megillah, Shehaya Aron Bechelko, that he was given the Kodesh HaKadoshim area where he would have the Aron, he would have the Holy Ark in his portion. So what's going on over here? What's the notion of this gerrymandering where the Binyamin goes up until the Yehuda goes up until the southeastern corner, and he has this one Amma, because the one Amma intrudes into the area of the Mizbeach, therefore there was no Yesod of the Mizbeach in that area, so that the Mizbeach would remain pristine within Binyamin's portion. So the Maharsha in Zevachim makes the following critical observation. The Maharsha says at source 9, Lefi Atam, the reason is precisely because of what we've been talking about and what the Ramban was mentioning in connection with the Chashmonaim. Lefi Atam, Keser Kehuna Lechud VeKeser Malchus Lechud, that you can't have a touching between the Keser Kehuna and the Keser Malchus. Now, it's true, Binyamin were not Kohanim, but nonetheless, they represented the portion that pertained to the Kohanim, while Yehuda represented the portion that pertained to the Malchus. L'kach HaMikdash, Shu Keser Kehuna, so the base of Mikdash, which was the Keser Kehuna, could not have an ownership on the part of Shevet Yehuda. Lo Aya B'chelek Yehuda Asher Lo HaMalucha, because Yehuda stands for the Malchus, and you can't have an intrusion of the Malchus. Once you have an intrusion of the Malchus, that could compromise the integrity of the Kahuna, the integrity of the spiritual welfare of the nation. The spiritual welfare has to remain intact. of a Lishkas Hagazis. But interestingly, the Lishkas Hagazis itself, Shisham HaMishpah, we could have the Sanhedrin. So there, even though we spoke about in the Drosha Saran of this distinction between the Shoftim and the Melech, that was okay to be in the Shevet of Yehuda Yechelko. Kamashikasu Melech HaMishpat Yamid Arts, that you could have a Melech who's dealing with Inyanei Mishpatim. And this is the explanation as to why the Amma of Yehuda could not be in the Chalik of the Mizbeach. There could be a role, I guess we could say through Alpi the Drosha Saran, there could be a role that a Melech could play in supplementing the Mishpat, which is done by the Shoftim. When it comes, however, to the most pristine level of Kedusha and spirituality, which is represented by the Kohanim, so there you cannot have any role, any chalik whatsoever. Since the Mizbeach, which represents the Keser Kohuna, cannot be, should not be, in a place of Malchus, so therefore that Amma, which was not in the Chalak of Binyamin, rather in the Chalak of Yehuda, did not have a foundation because it had to be kept separate and distinct from the Mizbeach and the Avoda of the Mizbeach, which could not be in a Chalak of Malchus. Now, of course, what's not elaborated upon is why in the world did it have to come so close? Why, if it was so important to have the separation, so why was this Ritzua that Yehuda should have surrounding the Mizbeach in the southeastern corner of the Mizbeach? And what's this notion that Binyamin was so upset that he wanted to be notel or bolea this portion, and because Binyamin felt so strongly about it, therefore he got a schar, that he ended up with the makom of the Aron? So that really raises, you know, its own set of questions. But it could be that maybe part of the answer to that question is that while it's extremely important, as we said, that there be a separation in order to maintain the integrity of the religion, in order to maintain the integrity of the Torah, part of maintaining that integrity, at least in our tradition, is that the Malchus understands that it's necessary for the administration of the sovereign state of the Malchus itself to keep the Torah strong. And therefore, there needs to be a desire, even on the part of the Malchus, to be part of this enterprise. The separation can't be so complete that they're both operating in competing domains. Just like the Melech has to walk around with the Sefer Torah at all times to remind himself that he's subservient to the Torah, and the chief quality of the Melech is to have Yirah Shemayim. Therefore, it's appropriate that the Melech should be there. It should be there quietly, as a passive participant, as an onlooker. It's living there in the southeastern corner and not really doing anything because there's no Yisov over there, but it's important for the Melech to actually be there. And by the same token, it's also praiseworthy that the Keser Kahuna, represented by Binyamin, in the ownership of the Mizbeach area, should have a desire to be notel or to be bolea additional area. Why be bolea this additional area? So bolea, I think, is a very telling word. Bolea also can be understood as meaning to swallow, but it also can be understood as meaning to absorb. And it could be that part of the attitude which is necessary in order for the success of the kingdom is for the religious leadership to be able to absorb the Malchus, to be able to absorb within their own application of the Torah an ability to work together with the leaders of the nation in promoting the welfare of a Torah state. So while they have to remain separate and distinct in terms of how the Avodah is done, how the Avodah Hashem is done, they don't assume the Malchus, they have to be careful and not to go beyond the pristine letter of the law in how Torah is administered. At the same time, it's in their interest to look out to make sure that the Malchus is behaving properly, that the Malchus doesn't go too far, that the Malchus is under their watch at all times, that the Malchus is somehow absorbed under within the spiritual nature of the kingdom. And therefore, that is the praiseworthiness and the merit of Binyamin wanting to be Bolea, that extra Amma. And what is the reward? So the reward is, as Rashi says, right, it becomes, the Gemara says, that it becomes the Ushpizin, Ushpizinche, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Ashchina, becoming the host, that is manifested through the Makom of the Aron. The Makom of the Aron is what? That is the chief place where the Torah resides. If the attitude of those who are charged with the spiritual welfare of the nation is that they have to look out to make sure that even the Malchus behaves properly and behaves in accordance with Torah principles, and that the Malchus is kind of working under their watchful eye, so that is what ultimately enables for the preservation of the Torah. And therefore, the natural reward becomes, this is all my drasha, the natural reward becomes that Binyamin earning the Makom Ha'aron, the Makom of the Torah. And this notion of the job of the religious legislators to make sure that the Malchus remains in check is, I think, reflected in the last non-English source that I have on the page, which is source 10, and that's the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Yutes Amanal. The Gemara there reflects a tension that arose between one of the Malachim, actually one of the Chashmonai Malachim, just to wrap it all together, who lived probably around 150 to 200 years before the destruction of the Bayis Sheni. His name was Yanai HaMelech. Yanai HaMelech was from the Chashmonaic dynasty. Interesting stories throughout the Gemara about Yanai HaMelech. So we're told in Sanhedrin, we're told that a melech is lodon v'lodonin also, that a melech is not somebody who can be brought in for judgment. So then the Gemara says, what are you talking about? We find that, of course, a melech can be brought in for judgment. So the Gemara says, well, that's true about melech, melech Yehuda. It's true about a melech that comes from the Malchus of Yehuda, who's a real melech according to the Lo Yosef Shevet Mi Yehuda dynasty. But Malchus Yisrael, who are not from Shevet Yehuda, there we don't have the same rule, and they are not subject to the justice system. So why is that? Mishum Maisa Shehoya, because of a certain Maisa that occurred. What was the Maisa that occurred? The Avda the Yanai Malka Kotel Nafsha. The Evid of Yanai Melech killed somebody. So Amalahu Shimon ben Shetach l'chachamim. Shimon ben Shetach, who happened also to have been the brother-in-law of Yanai HaMelech. So Shimon, I believe that Shimon's sister was married to Yanai HaMelech. So Shimon ben Shetach said to the chachamim, Tzinuei Nechem Bo Venito Nenenu, we have to judge him. The rule is that his Eved killed, so he's obligated to come to judgment, because we may sentence the Eved to death. That's going to have monetary consequences for him, so therefore he's part of this case. Shokhuleh, they sent for Yanai HaMelech. Shimon ben Shetach was also the Abbez. So Shokhuleh Avdach Katul Nafsha, so they said to Yanai HaMelech, your Eved killed somebody. Shadre Lu. So he sent, so they sent to him. Shokhuleh. So he sent his Eved to them. He said, okay, fine, you want my Eved, I'll send you my Eved. But he didn't come himself. So Shokhuleh, so then they sent back to him, on to Nami Lahachi. Lahacha, you also have to come. It's not just your Eved, because it says, who ad bivalov. You have to testify, just like when a shor kills. You need the Baal to be there. So when the Eved kills, the Eved also would have had monetary ramifications for Yanai HaMelech. He had to be there. So Amar Torah, Yavo Baal HaShor V'Yamar HaShor. He has to be there with respect to his Eved. Asav Yasav. So you know what? He came. Yanai HaMelech actually came. This was a deference. It was not the notion of that a king is impervious to the law of the Torah. A king is also subject to the law of the Torah. He came. But he only came up to a point. Amalei Shimon ben Shetach, Yanai HaMelech. So Shimon ben Shetach said, Yanai HaMelech, You have to show your subservience to the Torah and the Torah system. You have to show your subservience to the Sanhedrin. You have to stand up. Made an understanding that you're not just standing in front of us who are your subjects. You're standing in front of a Kaddish Baruch Hu. Your job is Melech. You're standing before a Kaddish Baruch Hu. When you stand in front of the Sanhedrin, you stand in front of the Torah sages, you're standing in front of a Kaddish Baruch Hu. Ultimately, you must have deference for this body because your ultimate deference is not to yourself in your office, but to a Kaddish Baruch Hu himself. So Amalo, so Yanai and Melech said to Shimon ben Shetach, and here he was testing the monarchy, and this is what led to a terrible disaster that caused them to suspend this law of the Melech Yisrael coming for judgment in the future, which was not ideal, as we'll see. But what happened was, he said, it's not like, I'm not listening just to what you say, but rather, I want to hear what the other members of the Sanhedrin have to say. Maybe he was arguing, you don't have authority in this case because you're my brother-in-law. I don't know. But he was saying, but his challenge was, let me see if the other members of the Sanhedrin agree that I have to stand up. So Nifne Yamino turned to the right. Suddenly, everybody was coward. The members of the Sanhedrin on the right side were coward. Nifle Smolo turned to the left. They were also coward. So Amalehen Shimon ben Shetzach, Malei Machshavos Atem, Yavama Machshavos Yiparim Mikem. Your people are fanciful thoughts that you're thinking too much and not acting as you're supposed to, so the Baal Machshavos will have to come and punish you. Miyab by Gavriel, the Malach, came, Mechavton Mekarka, and beat everybody up, Umesu, and they all died, Be'osa Sha'amu. So it was decreed at that time, Melech lo darim lo darin oiso, lo meid in oiso. That the Melech, at least the Melech Yisrael, cannot be brought in for judgment because of this terrible calamity that occurred. But we see the tension that arose at the time in which the jurisdiction of Yanai HaMelech was challenged, in which he was called for the test to show his allegiance to the Torah as he was supposed to do. But we see what a terrible conflicts can arise when there's a feeling on the part of those who are entrusted with Torah authority that they have to be cowered by the Melech, and where the Melech also on his own does not give due deference to their ultimate authority to govern the Torah affairs of the state. And this is what led to, unfortunately, the killing of all of the deaths of all of the members of the Sanhedrin, who are described in this passage in the Gemara. And I believe what the Gemara is highlighting here is precisely the importance of navigating this tension very, very carefully, because there is a tension. There is a necessity to keep a separate realm between those who are serving as the spiritual leaders of the people and those who are serving as members of the Malchus, in order not to compromise the mandate of the religious authorities on the one hand, in order not to compromise the tradition of the Malchus Yehuda, at least, you know, when we're dealing with the Ramban's case of Lo Yosef Shevet Miyehuda, on the other hand. When the two clash, this is what reveals whether you have a smoothly running Torah society or whether, unfortunately, you do not. And the ultimate test is whether the Melech internalizes the lesson of walking around with the Sefer Torah and understanding that he's subservient to the Yiras Hashem Elokav, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and understands that his main role is to exhibit this Yiras Hashem, and whether he has an appreciation of the fact that those who are entrusted with the religious authority of the state, even though he has the ability to legislate beyond that in terms of preserving law and order and to fulfill the role of the monarchy, ultimately there needs to be an understanding that the spiritual administration of the state cannot be subject to interference. It cannot be subject to the authority of the Melech. It cannot be subject to the subjugation of the Melech. So whenever you create a society where you have this interference, where you have, say, a state which has any kind of say or interference with matters of religion, then you become vulnerable to the challenges and to the pitfalls that are described by this Gemara. An extreme manifestation of this, obviously, were the deaths of members of the Sanhedrin, but one can imagine certainly many scenarios which, you know, may be a little bit less extreme, but perilous and dangerous nonetheless. If you have a state where, for example, it's up to governmental officials to decide who they're going to appoint as dayanim, where you have governmental commissions which would be deciding what the standards of conversion should be among the Batei Din. These are some of the challenges that have arisen even in the state of Israel, which really grapples with this issue over the last number of years, of decades, and that they are still struggling with. But if we're going to get guidance from our essential sources, what the guidance tells us is that the religious authorities have to be able to have complete autonomy, that there can't be interference from the government with respect to the realm that's given to the religious authorities. That has to remain pristine. That has to remain untouched. You can go up until the Mizbeach, but you can't go any further. At the same time, they have to exist as neighbors, where basically they are still living in the same realm with everybody understanding what their separate functions are. So there is a separation between religion and state in halacha. It's primarily to protect the religion. And ultimately, by protecting the religion, that is what enables for the protection of the state as well, because the state will be strongest when the religion is strongest. The Ramban indicates the role of the Kohanim is as the spiritual leaders of the nation to do Avodas Hashem, but that has to be contained. As long as the Kohanim understand themselves that their role is purely in the realm of religion, that enables the Malchus to flourish much better with those who assume the mantle of the Malchus. So those who are charged with the spiritual welfare have to understand their place. Those who are charged with the governmental authority of the Malchus have to understand their place. And both of them have to understand that all of the Kavod comes from the ultimate Melech HaKavod, who is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because ultimately the Malchus will not be successful in terms of maintaining a Torah state, in terms of being able to preserve the Makom HaAron, if there isn't this appreciation that there has to be deference to the overriding importance of preserving the spiritual nature of the nation and of the integrity of the Torah. Now, it's very interesting, just as a footnote, that I alluded to earlier, that within the United States, there is, you know, this very strong doctrine of separation between religion and state. I quoted to you the applicable clause in the Constitution that was interpreted by one of the founding fathers of the United States of America, namely Thomas Jefferson, as standing for this notion of erecting a wall between religion and state. But not everybody necessarily understands this as flowing so clearly from the Constitution, thus creating an interesting tension that exists even within this country. I'll just, you know, quote from two speeches over the last 50 years or so on the subject. You have John F. Kennedy, who gave a really great speech. I'd recommend it, you know, if anybody ever has access to YouTube. It was given on September 12, 1960. I actually watched the speech, to the Greater Houston Ministerial Association. And John F. Kennedy said, and he says it very eloquently because he has this really, you know, commanding accent, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute. I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish. I do not speak for my church on public matters, and the church does not speak for me." In which he was reflecting that his understanding, at least, of the concept for purposes of America was that the Malchus, shall we say, the governmental leader, is completely untouched by matters of religion, and of course, vice versa. Now, just to give you a contrast, one of the Republican one of the Republican candidates, he's since withdrawn from the race, in this year's presidential election, was a former senator from Pennsylvania named Rick Santorum, said in words that were diametric diametrically opposed to the famous speech of John F. Kennedy, which you'd figure would be the last word on the subject because, you know, it's John F. Kennedy, you know. But Rick Santorum, just kind of reflecting some of the tensions that exist even within his own country, said, I don't believe in an America where the separation of church and state are absolute. The idea that the church could have no influence and no involvement in the operation of the state is absolutely antithetical to the objectives and vision of our country. Therefore, you see that it's not necessarily such a simple subject, even within the confines of this country, but what they were arguing about, I think fundamentally, was the question as to whether, for purposes of American society, there was an understanding and a value the notion that there is a place for a religious tradition to affect the morals of the people and the discourse of the people and the legislation, even as there is an assurance that the state won't establish a particular religion and will not discriminate against free exercise of any religion. So I'll conclude that particular aspect of the discussion with just an excerpt from the letter that was written by the real, you know, McCoy, genuine founding father of the country, George Washington. And George Washington, when he wrote a letter to the Toro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island, in 1790, when he was expressing his understanding of religious tolerance, said something very, very interesting, which is that it's a misnomer to speak about tolerance or toleration. Tolerance implies that there is some sort of an official tradition, and you're tolerating those who stray from the official tradition. So said George Washington, all possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent national gifts. There's no class that's officially in charge. But happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, very eloquent phrases that he borrowed from the letter of the sexton of the synagogue that was written to him, requires only that they who live under his protection should demean themselves as good citizens and giving it on all occasions their effectual support. So his attitude in general was that the most important objective in what was he was trying to establish in the creation of any kind of a structure of religious liberty was not to put one group ahead of any other group or one particular religious vision ahead of any other religious vision, but that everybody should be able to be on equal footing in terms of practicing and exercising and expressing their views and living their lives in accordance with their religious traditions. I think that probably is the perspective that could be read perhaps in different nuanced ways into both the speech that was given by Kennedy and the speech that was given to Santorum. But I think in this country, what is probably best for all peoples is to enable everybody to have the freedom to make a contribution in terms of expressing their own religious tradition and putting it into the national collective dialogue. But this is different and distinct from the tradition of having a country according to Torah tradition, where we also have a notion of an importance between an importance of separating between religious authority and state authority. But it's important to remember that within this model, the ultimate objective is of everybody having an awareness of the sacred nature of the Torah tradition and the vital overriding importance of having Yiras Shamayim. Thank you very much.